in all, a continued period of tension with a country which already has a fairly well-developed ballistic missile program and, of course, has made progress, although exactly how much is not clear, in the direction of nuclear weapons. Let's talk a bit about that tonight with a retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargas Singari. He is now CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. And Colonel, thank you for joining us tonight.
Jim, it was good to be here.
Thank you very much. You were born and raised in Iran and immigrated to the United States in 1980 at the age of 10 after the Iranian Revolution. It would therefore, I guess, be safe to say things must have changed quite a bit from your personal memory.
They have changed, but as much as they change, they remain the same. Iran's still trying to resolve the issue of why it went through a whole process of a revolution, and they still haven't been able to answer the final outcome of it.
To what extent is the Iranian government the product of the extremely strong Islamist viewpoints of the mullahs, and to what extent is that government a reflection of Iran, the country, regardless of how it was ruled? That is to say, Iran under the Shah, Iran even under something that we might call a relatively democratic society. How much of this government is just intrinsically Iranian?
It is Iranian because it's still nationalistic. However, it is an Islamic republic in itself, so that means it has to follow the mandates of Islam regardless of where it's operating internationally or within its own borders. We wrote an article in the Near East recently looking at the anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. And in it, I indicated that, you know, you had Iranian businessmen at the time, living in Iran, living a life of luxury. In the morning, they would eat breakfast in their houses. They would fly to France. They would do shopping, eat a late dinner, and then fly back and be in their beds by the same day. And these individuals all decided collectively to go ahead and endorse a Islamic Republic. So at the end of the day, regardless of the status by which they live by, the mandates of Islam do have a larger calling, regardless of if they're living with the enormity of what the West has to offer them or they're living in the Middle East.
I would say that there are some aspects of Islam that are still difficult for me to understand. And again, I'm aware of the fact that Christianity is extremely splintered and many various distinctions and branches and sects, but Islam probably even more so. But one thing that I've never understood would be some of the, let's say, the leaders of the oil sheikhdoms, let's say, in the other side of the Persian Gulf, places of immense wealth. You have people there who are known for being very, very pious Muslims when they're there in their homes. Then they'll go to some place like Monte Carlo, where they are legendary for everything, drinking, gambling, womanizing, what have you. And then they'll head right back to their homes in the Middle East and again revert to being very pious, almost as if Allah can't see over the horizon. And I've never understood that. Now, that isn't to say the Christians don't engage in hypocritical behavior, but at least we are supposed to feel bad about it. That's why we have things like penance and confession and whatever your branch of Christianity may be. I'm not sure that concept even exists, does it, in Islam?
The problem you have, and this is also what leads into the regional strife that we're dealing with on a global level, is that Islam has never had a singular type of a person that would speak on behalf of Islam internationally.
No pope, as it were.
There's no pope, as it were. So we have a pope. You know, not everybody agrees with him. We are denominationally different, but at least when he speaks at the UN or at the White House, and we know that he's speaking from a perspective of what Christianity is looking at overall. Islam doesn't have it. So you've had Turkey for years trying to jockey to be the head of this caliphate in the region, Saudi Arabia trying to be the leader of Islam when it comes to Sunni Islam and being more Arabic than it is Persian when it comes to the various different Sunni tribal groups. and Iran trying to be the head of the Shia, all of Islam, collectively. Now, if you look at it, when Muhammad initially established the Islamic religion, it came out of the Bedouin concepts of the Saudi Arabia. But the problem was Saudi Arabia ran smack into this Persian culture, this nationalistic concept, and it was never able to understand how to work within that structure because it was tribal, where Persia had an empire, actually had rule over various different areas within the empire, had a culture. So although it accepted Islam as its religion, it could not function at the level that Saudi would like to see it function at that time, Muhammad. So that's why you've always had this friction point between them. And today we don't have a lead for Islam.
I note an article that you wrote, to understand foreign policy, you wrote, understand backyard wars. And I'll just quote the first paragraph of this. Russia's dealings with Iran have followed a similar trajectory of failure, primarily due to their contrasting political ideologies and, more significantly, the cultural underpinnings of those ideologies. As Rudyard Kipling famously observed, East is East and West is West and never the twain shall meet. This is true, and maybe especially so, even when the East, i.e. Iran, is a backyard state of the West, i.e. Russia or the European Union. Maybe we should start here with your understanding of this situation by defining for the rest of us what is a backyard state.
Well, the backyard states are any places that we presume to be our backyard. And the reason I wrote it in this fashion was to give an understanding to the common person that everybody has a backyard if they own a house. You know, for us, if a squirrel comes into our backyard and tries to, you know, attack our apple tree, we take certain measures against them. Now, imagine when world polities take a look at the aspects of having, you know, another large nation state trying to meddle, whether it be in Venezuela, in the Middle East, or in this case, with us trying to strike a deal with North Korea in the backyard of China. The problem we have currently is that in the old days, we used to have these proxy wars that would be fought in these backyard states. Unfortunately, now, because the world economies are so tied together, when we have a fight, no longer is the Middle East the backyard of Russia only. It is also the backyard of China, United States. And when we are trying to negotiate a deal maybe with Iran, we're also getting into the backyards of China because Iran does belong to this Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And we are meddling even in the backyard of our allies, in this case, the European Union, that would like to see a better deal for them economically in the Iranian bazaars than we would like to see for the U.S. businesses. So these maturations are what I was trying to point out in this article, so we can understand and link analysis of why our foreign policy sometimes seems disjointed, but is actually coherent in how we actually approach our needs to affect our backyards.
I'm going to come back and talk some more about this, as I think it's a good key to helping to understand that region to the extent that it's possible for Western eyes and ears to understand the Middle East, the Near East, and that area. We're talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sargari, and he is the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. They're online at their initials, NEC-SE.com, NEC-SE.com. And we'll be back on the Jim Bohannon Show in just a moment. Talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sargari. He is now the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. And we're taking a look. Says he was born in Iran and lived there until the age of 10, just after the Iranian Revolution. We're getting his perspective on some of the problems in dealing with that country, and one of them being this concept of the backyard state. And as the colonel noted, there's a problem when backyards overlap, which, of course, in this day and age of satellites and the Internet, it happens more and more frequently. And as you put it here, simply put, backyard states commonly dislike being backyard states and are opposed to viewing themselves as such. and a failure to consider the socio-political history of a state can lead to increasing tension. Is that true here, or are we simply dealing with two governing ideologies that are incompatible?
Yes and no. I mean, both can apply. It depends. I mean, we could use a viewpoint of Venezuela. United States came on and said, we want a regime change. It's going to happen within 48 hours. It's in our backyard. And how many months have passed? Nobody's even talking about a regime change in Venezuela. The reason being because the administration, as far as the, not the policymakers, but the bureaucracy, did not recognize the fact that you have Russia in Venezuela, Hezbollah in Venezuela. You have the people in Venezuela who are more socialist in ideology than it might be economically. So these are the issues that lead to those friction points that when the bureaucracies cannot address, leads to a foreign policy that seems like is inept, for a better term, but maybe even leans forward in saddle earlier than it should have when it says that we can see a regime change within our region. So, and again, Venezuela doesn't see itself as a backyard state, just like Iran doesn't see itself as a backyard state. If it did, it would not be standing against the U.S. within the region, and it would not be boarding British ships in order to exert its independence and capability over those waterways.
It is said that politics makes strange bedfellows, and apparently that includes diplomacy as well. And I'm aware of the old axiom, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but that seems to be carried to the extreme in some cases these days. Of course, in the battles that finally erased the Islamic State, at least has a place on a map. You had the United States and revolutionary forces from Iran acting in concert both against that state. And I gather there was even a certain amount of coordination between the presence of the Iranian forces and U.S. airstrikes. And likewise with, for example, Hezbollah in Venezuela, for example, or Russia, say, backing Iran. These are linkages that are hard to understand, I suppose. Perhaps you could explain that in the concept of backyard states. Is ideology or political differences simply going by the board in favor of I guess the notion the enemy of my enemy is my friend?
To an extent, they are, but that's because the battlefield has changed. It's much more fluid than it used to be in the past. One of the reasons, as I'll use an example, in 2014, Japan bought majority of U.S. debt. Because they did so, Russia was able to put pressure on North Korea, to put pressure on Japan at the time, with the possibility of conducting strikes against them with the ballistic missile capability in order to be able to expand its footprint in Syria, which limited the previous administration from being able to take any actions in Syria because they did not want to see a larger war in Asia. So now North Korea was doing it for their own benefit because they wanted to bring United States to the negotiation tables in order to be able to strike a deal for itself as far as being a future economic hub in Asia. But at the same time, Russia was using North Korea to be able to put pressure on Japan, which bought U.S. debt, in order to be able to expand its footprint in Syria, checking the U.S. At the same time, U.S. was handcuffed because if it tried to do anything to alleviate its economic pressures, which Japan had taken off of it burden-wise, it would have to increase its rates as far as the interest rates were concerned, and that would mean that the Bank of Japan would be held in check holding American debt, and it would actually crash the Japanese economy, which is the significant piece of what we needed in order to open up the bazaars of Iran, which even the current administration working out. So all these things are kind of tied together, and it depends on where you're kind of putting the pressure on as far as the link analysis is concerned, which is the reason why our foreign policy sometimes seems is in flux, but is actually tied together through these processes.
Is it possible for the U.S. and Iran to coexist, or is some kind of military conflict inevitable?
Well, look, at the end of the day, they're all people. And what we call diplomacy is just a process of getting to bringing somebody to the table. Even war eventually gets somebody to the table. You try not to get to that level. And I think as to what is happening within the region and the patience that have been shown by the current administration, it is very possible that we may have already struck a deal with Iran. It's just a matter of going through these maturations to finally allow both sides to come to the table in the strongest position possible to ensure that we have a long, enduring peace between the two nations. However, with that said, that would mean that if Iran wins, then all our Sunni allies would have to be buried in the process, whether it be Turkey or what happens internally in Saudi Arabia. One of these sides will win, the other side will lose.
1-866-50-JIMBO, our number, 1-866-505-4626. And we'll continue our discussion here as we try to understand the Iranians. No one is certainly suggesting that that a war is a good idea. On the other hand, it is hard to see, I suppose, a certain level of compatibility with phrases like the great Satan and the little Satan, meaning, of course, the United States and Israel. It is difficult to see a confluence, if you will, of Western thought processes and separation of church and state with an ideology which in many ways is virtually medieval and in some ways, I suppose, could even be considered somewhat fascistic at some of the circumstances that are perhaps common to Iran with maybe some other countries, such as a dislike of backyard state status. Let me talk to you a little bit about the relationship that Iran has in the region, in particular the other regional power there, Saudi Arabia. Is Iran isolating Saudi Arabia, or for that matter, is Saudi Arabia isolating Iran?
Saudi Arabia is isolating itself, and Iran is isolating Saudi Arabia. So both apply. Unfortunately, like I said, in this war between who's going to be the leader of Islam, some of the steps that we have taken have also helped Iran to isolate Saudi Arabia, which is one of our allies. As an example, when Iran shoots down the American drone, it's basically saying to the rest of the world of Islam, look, we are standing against the tyranny of the West. We are standing for Islam. We are fighting against the U.S. by shooting down their drone, while Saudi Arabia is allowing even Israel to have flyovers of their airspace in case there's a shooting war in the future against us. At the same time, when they take an oil tanker, they're basically saying we're able to exert our capabilities within the region to defend what we believe is our waterways, and those international waters could be disputed either way by any of the countries that wants to make a claim, while Saudi Arabia is basically signing checks for the U.S. and other Western nations to execute a war against us. So the longer this takes, the more powerful Iran becomes in the long run. Now, either we're doing it without that intention, but that's how the information operation campaign is playing out, or we have already realized that if you are going to bring Iran to the table to strike a new deal, then it's better to bring Iran to the table in a little bit more of a powerful position, because then it allows us to have a long, enduring agreement with them. Because if you think about it, the previous administration has struck an agreement which the current administration broke. From the Iranian perspective, the issue is, what guarantees do I have that the following administration after you is not going to come in and break that agreement? So it would be better if we get to a treaty, possibly. And if we play our cards right, hopefully we will get to a point where we will have a long-term agreement and possibly a treaty ratified by Congress when it comes to Iran and its ballistic capabilities.
1-866-50-JIMBO. And I want to get to a call here, but first I have to ask a follow-up to that. We have been told, we in the West, whose knowledge of Islam is rudimentary at best, but of course we've been forced over the last 40 years to learn a little bit, and the one thing that most of us learned quickest was there's never been a split between Protestant and Catholic that remotely resembles the split between Sunni and Shia. And I'm wondering, how powerful is the message of Iran saying, we're standing up for Islam? Wouldn't the response be from much of that region, well, you're standing up for the Shia version of Islam, not the Sunni version. How important is that distinction?
It is important, but if you know, the Shia Arabs are much more apt to support Iran than it would be the Sunni Arabs within the entire Sunni region supporting Saudi's version of what it wants as far as projecting his notions of what the overall Islam should be for the region. Or in this case, you'll see the split between the Sunnis, whether it be the Sunni Muslim Kurds as a tribal group, choosing between Turkey or choosing between Saudi Arabia, depending on who's going to take their oil and give them the business in the long run for their area of interest. And at the same time, as far as the jockeying, when it comes to Turkey trying to be the lead of Islam within the Sunni capabilities, Iran is the only one who's able to protect that capability. That's why Iran is able to have major movements within various different Sunni states that are specifically Arab but are tied to the Persian Iranian when it comes to its concept of Islam.
Colonel, to what extent can India play a role here, or are they outsiders? I mean, they're very close, obviously, to the region, as it were.
India is already playing a role, but I think one problem we have sometimes to get sucked into the region. So the countries that have been mentioned right now are only regional. You have to look globally. As an example, when we put sanctions against Iran, we allowed the port of Chabahar to be open. We removed the sanctions from there so India can do business with Iran. India is developing port for Iran in order to be able to run a railhead from that port specifically into Afghanistan. And the reason we allow that to happen is the only reason why the Taliban finally came to the negotiation tables, because that put pressure on Pakistan, where we were bypassing the ports in Pakistan and trying to develop a port for future linkage between India for U.S. interests through Iran into Afghanistan. The reason why we allow that to happen in order to support India has more to do with China and how we're trying to buffer against China and China's expansion through the China Cooperation Agreement into Afghanistan, into Europe, trying to strike new deals with Europe in order to bypass our tariff capabilities that we're placing on them to bring them to negotiation tables for a better economic deal for us.
Well, the backyard sure is growing.
Correct, it's growing. So the problem is, once the Ottoman Empire fell, the majority of the countries that have been mentioned were basically carved out. So they don't have the history except for the fact that we carved them out from what the old Ottoman Empire used to be. And Iran has always had a territorial capability there that existed long before it became Islam. And because of where it sits geographically, it is a key player regardless. We can knock out his military probably within hours if you want to sink all their ships and destroy them across the board. Yes, the mullahs are always going to be a threat against Israel. Israel doesn't just sit in a difficult position in the region. It literally sits in the hearts of the Bishs. But Israel is now striking deals with everyone else who wants to see it eliminated, to include Saudi Arabia. I've said multiple times to individuals in Israel who have asked me, I said, if Saudi Arabia really cared about Israel and the Jewish state, where were they 40 years ago when Iran started marching towards establishing capability to threaten the state?
Well, obviously, they don't really care about Israel. They simply recognize that Iran's becoming a bigger threat than Israel.
And they recognize that, and that's the only reason they care about them.
Exactly. I don't think anybody on either side is exactly lulled into a false sense of security. I don't think there's anybody in Tel Aviv saying, oh, the Saudis love us now. I mean, They are nothing if not realists.
Same thing in with the Sunni Muslim Kurds. Sunni Muslim Kurds were courted by the Israeli government going back to the 60s, even earlier than that, to be a destabilizing factor against Iran, which might be a threat to them because they saw this threat coming years ago, decades ago. But the problem is Iran is able to move all its capabilities through Iraqi Kurdish north into Syria and into Hezbollah-controlled areas. Why? Because they're, at the end of the day, Sunni Muslim Kurds.
We are way overdue for a break. We'll take that and come back with more calls in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Haddon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO. We're talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargas Singhalri, and he is now CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. And this is a call from Sharon in Crane, Missouri. Sharon, and good evening, and welcome to the program.
Good evening, Jim, and good evening, Colonel. An individual that is really got me concerned is Erdogan in Turkey.
Erdogan has never been a friend of the United States. Unfortunately, where Turkey sits, it has to play the good guy, bad guy all the time. I think within the next 72 hours, you'll probably see a resolution to Erdogan's future within the region, if not already. And eventually,
what exactly is going to happen in the next 72 hours?
This is a difficult time where the region sits at currently, and I think that a case has to be made whether or not Erdogan, who recently lost big in the most recent elections, will be still the head of Turkey overall. But I can tell you that his aspiration of being the caliphate of the region have ended completely, especially after that recent election.
How does he retain power after the election? Does he essentially assume dictatorial powers, or did the election merely weaken him and not close the door on his rule?
Well, I guess the only thing I could compare it to for American listeners is like the Death Star blowing up in Star Wars. Now you have to see if their empire is able to strike back, but I don't believe that they're capable in this capacity. Because the people have wanted a change internally, and there's a lot of issues that the coup that took place might have been internally generated for Erdogan to be able to solidify his base to begin with. With that said, because of where Turkey sits, even as a member of NATO, it constantly plays good guy, bad guy. It from day one has believed that the lands it owned were taken by the British and the French.
Oh, are we going back a century to the end of World War One here?
You have to, because that's what war does. And for people who want to get involved in conflict constantly, they have to understand that some of the ramifications are centuries old. Today, United States and Russia are competing in the region, with China sitting back waiting to pick up the pieces. If you cannot come to an understanding of how to operate when in this backyard, strictly because of the deal that was struck 100 years ago. And today, a new deal has to be struck between the major powers, and the two major powers within the region, going back to the Cold War, has been the U.S. and Russia. And whether we like it or not, we have to play that role in this case.
Yeah. Okay, quick question before the break. Briefly, Turkey's already been turned down for membership in the European Union, and nothing has changed there except to make it even more unlikely that it'll ever get a membership in the EU. Is Turkey still a viable member of NATO?
The problem we have is that every member of NATO has a right to strike deals with whatever nation they want, regardless, to include the European Union nations are part of NATO, bypassing our sanctions and trying to break new deals with Iran. So that has to be kept in mind. The problem with Turkey is Turkey has not only supported ISIS, when in the region has sold ISIS oil to the European community, and at the same time, as we are moving forward, is a reason why Europe is burning because of the refugees that are released directly into Europe, because Erdogan has always wanted to be the lead of Islam in the region.
Back with more in just a moment. Our guest is the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sirgani, and we're talking about the Middle East in general, Iran to begin with. We've switched over to Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and we have only mentioned Israel in passing more, but I'm wondering about your thoughts about our relationship with Israel. A general overview, which may or may not be accurate, I suppose, would probably say that, that things have been friendlier between the United States and Israel during the time of the Trump administration, particularly the moving of the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. Your thoughts about our dealings with Israel in general and the moving of that embassy in particular?
Well, the moving of the embassy was already agreed upon and passed through Congress years ago. President Trump
We never did it. I mean, that...
unfortunately, our foreign policy is sometimes tied to politics and bureaucrats that do not understand how the fabric of the region works. Israel has realized a long time ago that it has to do everything alone to be able to survive. That was just a reality of what it went through when it initially established itself. It is not in a difficult situation. It is in the heart of the abyss. And everyone that its ally in the region wants to wipe it off the face of the earth. So it has to do what it can to survive. It is good that we have a better relationship with Israel today under the current POTUS, but what happens after the current POTUS leaves? You cannot guarantee that the next POTUS comes in is going to have the same friendly relationship with Israel. So with that said, our only ally in the region is Israel. And if that ally is ever lost, then we have lost complete control of the region. Unfortunately, if we cannot check China, if we cannot resolve the issue with Iran, if we cannot convince the European Union to still stick with us for a viable long-term initiative as far as protecting itself economically and even internally security-wise, then as we get isolated, Israel will be in a much worse position than has been in the past, and currently is probably at one of the most dangerous positions it's ever been in. So the hope is that we're able to support Israel to sustain itself, but Israel has understood from our previous history that it has to do it by itself.
What is particularly dangerous now about Israel's circumstance? Is it Iran close to acquiring nuclear weapons to go with the missiles they already have? What makes today particularly dangerous for Israel?
Well, the nuclear weapons being one, but there's no guarantee that any of the allies are going to be able to support it. You know, we had 10 years of major conflict within the region, and we're at the brinks of even internal issues when in the Israeli politics, that might flip that region into a position where the next decade would be as bloody as the previous one, if not bloodier. And when you're talking about 150,000 missiles sitting on the border of Lebanon and Israel, and you're looking at 200,000 on the border of Syria and Israel, with Russia controlling Syria and China, now exerting its pressure within the region, Israel is pretty much isolated and doesn't have any friends within the region that it can count on.
All right. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Again, we're talking with retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sirgani. He is the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, online at their initials, NEC-SE.com. That's NEC-SE.com. I'm Jim Bohannon, and this is Westwood One.